Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The United States and Cuba restored full diplomatic relations just past 12 a.m. Monday after more than 5 decades of hostility. A few hours later in the pre-dawn quiet, the red, white, and blue Cuban flag was hoisted at the U.S. State Department alongside the flags of the other countries that have diplomatic relations with the U.S. The U.S. and Cuba each now have a full-fledged embassy in the other's country. The historic diplomatic shift comes 54 years after a diplomatic break that happened during U.S. President John F. Kennedy's administration. The U.N. Security Council is expected to give its approval Monday to the agreement Iran and a group of six world powers struck last week to limit the Iranian nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. The 15-member council is voting Monday morning, and since the five permanent veto-holding council members are signatories to the agreement, the resolution is almost certain to be adopted. Once passed, the deal would go into effect after no later than 90 days. The next key milestone would come after the UN nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, issues a report, expected in December, on the resolution of past and present issues with Iran's nuclear program. That is when Iran would see relief from the sanctions that have hurt its economy. The UN vote comes as U.S. lawmakers begin their own review of the agreement. Banks in cash-strapped Greece open Monday for the first time in 3 weeks. Bank customers will be allowed to make a single withdrawal of $455 a week instead of just $65 in daily withdrawals. However, restrictions on cash transfers abroad will remain in place. This is VOA News. U.S. Defense Chief Ash Carter said Monday that Israel is the bedrock of American strategy in the Mideast, opening a trip to the region aimed at strengthening U.S. links with allies that are wary of the new internationally negotiated Iranian nuclear accord. Secretary of Defense Carter was warmly welcomed by his counterpart, Moshe Ya'alon, and is set to meet Tuesday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has called the pact blocking Tehran from building a nuclear weapon a historic mistake. On his arrival, Carter sought to assure Israel of staunch U.S. support.
The purpose of my trip is to work on all the things that we do together to guarantee the security of American interests in the region, and very importantly, one of those is the security of Israel.
Ya'alon thanked Carter for the U.S. contributions to Israeli security in the troubled Mideast. A suicide bombing in Turkey's southeastern city of Suruk has killed at least 28 people and left nearly 100 others dead, or rather injured. No one has claimed responsibility for Monday's attack, although Turkish officials say they have strong reasons to believe it was perpetrated by Islamic State militants. The ministry called for people to remain calm in the face of the attack that it said targeted the country's unity. U.S. President Barack Obama is hosting Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari for a meeting Monday at the White House, with the threat posed by Boko Haram militants expected to top the agenda. The two leaders, along with U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, will also likely discuss proposed political and economic reforms in Nigeria aimed at ending widespread corruption. Disagreements over Syria have strained relations between allies Turkey and the United States. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul. Analysts say there are signs both sides could be starting to work more closely together in battling Islamic State.
Ankara and Washington described as positive the visit this month of the head of the international coalition tasked with destroying the Islamic State, retired U.S. General John Allen. Past meetings have been tense and difficult, with Washington frustrated over Ankara's insistence that Islamic State can only be defeated after the removal of the Assad regime. Iran is also giving Washington a potential new driving force for a rapprochement with Ankara. Observers claim new dynamics in the region could provide a powerful force to consolidate relations between the two NATO partners. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Police in southeastern Afghanistan say American helicopters bombed a security outpost Monday morning, killing at least 8 Afghan soldiers, wounding several others in what appears to be a so-called friendly fire incident. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A new report largely blames man-made factors for most disaster-related displacement. The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center of the Norwegian Refugee Council reports more than 19.3 million people in 100 countries were forced to flee their homes in 2014 because of natural disasters such as floods, storms, and earthquakes.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from the launch of the report in Geneva. Details next. Also in the news, special court in Senegal began a long-awaited trial today against former Chadian ruler Hissène Habré on charges of crimes against humanity. And U.S. President Barack Obama is hosting Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari for a meeting today at the White House. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Guinea, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, a new report largely blames man-made factors for most disaster-related displacement. The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center of the Norwegian Refugee Council reports more than 19.3 million people in 100 countries were forced to flee their homes in 2014 because of natural disasters such as floods, storms, and earthquakes. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center of the Norwegian Refugee Council report finds an average of 22.5 million people have been displaced by climate or weather-related disasters each year since 2008. It says Asia, which is home to 60% of the world's population, accounts for 87% of those displaced last year. It notes people in China, India, and the Philippines were the most severely affected. In 2014, the report says Europe experienced double its average level of displacement for the past 7 years, while displacement in Africa was three times lower than the average. But relative to their population size, the report says many African countries, such as Sudan, experienced high levels of disaster displacement. The report notes climate change is expected to increase the frequency and intensity of natural disasters. It says rapid economic development, urbanization, and population growth in hazard-prone areas are the man-made factors driving an overall trend in increasing disaster displacement. Internal Displacement Monitoring Center Director Alfredo Zamudio says the likelihood of people becoming displaced by disaster today is 60% higher than four decades ago.
Our report shows that how it is not the hazard itself that determines the devastation it causes. In fact, much of it is driven by man-made factors. Indeed, most of the displacement is related to the impact of climate or weather hazards.
The International Organization for Migration assisted in data collection for the report. IOM Director General William Lacey Swing tells VOA the impact on forced migration when climate change kicks in will exacerbate an already serious situation.
There are more people in movement today than at any other time in recorded history, about 1 billion out of our 7 billion world. Quarter of these crossing borders and three quarters moving within their own country. Secondly, the percentage of these who are forced to migrate is also unprecedented.
Authors of the report say preventive measures such as the construction of buildings that can withstand earthquakes or early warning systems to alert communities of the onset of storms or floods can reduce the risks from natural hazards and lighten their tragic after effects. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Burundi holds a controversial national election tomorrow after weeks of deadly violence. From Bujumbura, Mohamed Yusuf reports the electoral body says it is ready for the presidential vote and is working around the clock with the security agencies to secure the polling centers and voters.
In the past 3 months, more than 100 people have been killed and at least 150,000 have fled Burundi into neighbouring countries since President Pierre Nkurunziza announced his bid to run for a third term. National Election Commission spokesman Prosper Ntahogwamiye says the election board is prepared for the polling. Ntahogwamiye says the election officials are briefing the polling station officials about the electoral processes and distributing voting materials in different polling centres across the country. He says they are urging officials and workers to collaborate with the security agencies in making sure there is enough security for both the election materials and voters. There is fear among some voters that the polling will be marred by violence. The last remaining opposition candidates withdrew from the presidential race, saying the country's political situation, including widespread intimidation and the threat of violence, does not allow for free, fair and peaceful elections. The pullout by the opposition is seen by many as a blow to the democratic process in Burundi. The Electoral Commission notes the names of the candidates will remain on the ballot papers. With President Pierre Nkurunziza the only candidate, Ntahogwamiye says it is uncertain when the result will be announced. He says the law does not specify an exact time or date to announce the results, but an effort will be made to announce the results as soon as possible. Critics have insisted President Nkurunziza must step aside after serving the two constitutionally allowed terms. But Burundi's constitutional court has ruled he's eligible for a third term because he was chosen by lawmakers and not popularly elected for his first term. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Bujumbura.
Doctors Without Borders says a refugee camp in Tanzania that houses more than 78,000 Burundians is at a breaking point. The International Medical Organization, also known as MSF, says about 1,000 Burundians cross the border daily in need of food, shelter and health care. Cholera has been a major health concern in the camp. The camp, first designed for 50,000, also holds more than 64,000 refugees from conflicts in the Democratic Republic of Congo. MSF assists the Tanzanian Red Cross in running the camp. A special court in Senegal began a long-awaited trial today for former Chadian ruler Hissène Habré on charges of crimes against humanity. The 72-year-old Habré and his lawyers have dismissed the court as lacking due process and said they would not take part in the trial. However, the accused was present today after authorities forced him to appear. The court was established under an agreement with the African Union. The court is to hear from 100 witnesses during the trial that is expected to last several months. Rights groups and a Chad Truth Commission accuse Habré of being responsible for more than 40,000 political killings, systematic tortures, and other violations during his time as president. He led the country between 1982 and 1990 when he was deposed by current leader Idriss Deby and fled to Senegal. Human Rights Watch called the trial a milestone in the fight to hold the perpetrators of atrocities accountable for their crimes in Africa and the world. It said the case marks the first time a court in one country is prosecuting the former ruler of another country for alleged human rights violations. This is a departure from the last 13 years during which similar cases have been brought by the International Criminal Court in The Hague. But the ICC has faced criticism for solely pursuing charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity against Africans and securing only two convictions since it began operating in 2002. U.S. President Barack Obama is hosting Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari for a meeting today at the White House, with the threat posed by Boko Haram militants expected to top the agenda. The two leaders, along with U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, will also likely discuss proposed political and economic reforms in Nigeria aimed at ending widespread corruption. The four-day trip is Mr. Buhari's first to Washington since being elected in March and taking office in May in a rare peaceful transition of power in Nigeria. The White House said the visit emphasizes U.S. commitment to strengthening and expanding our partnership with Nigeria's new government and supporting its people. Mr. Buhari will also have breakfast with Vice President Biden today and later meet with West African diplomats, World Bank executives, and members of the U.S. Congress. He is scheduled to hold a town hall meeting with Nigerians tomorrow. Both the U.S. and Nigeria appear eager to improve relations after years of strained ties under President Goodluck Jonathan. Nigerian officials had turned down some of the assistance the U.S. offered to combat Boko Haram, even after the militant group sparked international outrage with the kidnapping of more than 200 schoolgirls in May 2014. Sixteen past the hour. You are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. New research shows that more than 30 years into the HIV/AIDS epidemic, African women living with the HIV still face much stigma and discrimination. The study says it's affecting efforts to prevent mother-to-child transmission of the AIDS virus. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The community-led research was commissioned by the World Health Organization and done in Kenya, Namibia, and Nigeria. The study was conducted by the International Community of Women Living with HIV, or ICW, and the Global Network of People Living with HIV. Margaret Happy is an ICW advocacy officer based in Kampala, Uganda. She says stigma and discrimination in healthcare settings is hampering efforts to scale up early infant diagnosis of HIV.
The stigma is still existing, one, because of information. When I talk about information, it is a two-way. Information for the service providers, but also information for us as the community of people living with HIV, and in this case, I'm going to focus on the woman living with HIV.
Happy says despite current information about HIV prevention efforts, many healthcare providers and employees in Africa fail to acknowledge it. For example, the use of antiretroviral drugs to prevent infection.
They already know that treatment is prevention, although most of them have heard that if someone is on HIV treatment, is on ART treatment, he or she is less infectious. They still think that provided someone has been tested HIV positive, the person can still infect them. So due to lack of information, due to limited information by health service providers, they still have that stigma.
But she also says there's an attitude problem among many healthcare workers.
The negative attitude, the negative perception by health service providers also fuels stigma. Then we have stigma which is self-inflicted, which is also caused by many, many factors, especially around us as women living with HIV.
One Nigerian woman said in the report that instead of talking to her, nurses shouted and laughed at her because of her HIV status. Happy says pregnant women are often surrounded by relatives when they go to healthcare facilities or are giving birth. The relatives may not know the woman is HIV positive until health workers test the child for HIV.
It causes differential treatment, or it even causes violence, separation, divorce. And now the situation is worse by also the legal environment, which is not enabling. The legal environment which criminalizes a disease, which criminalizes HIV, for instance, in Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and other countries.
Happy says HIV-positive women often impose stigma upon themselves because of their economic dependence on men, either as daughters, partners, or spouses. Fear of separation, divorce, or violence can prevent women from disclosing their HIV status. The report is entitled Early Infant Diagnosis, Understanding the Perceptions, Values, and Preferences of Women Living with HIV in Kenya, Namibia, and Nigeria. It was released at the 8th International AIDS Society Conference on HIV Pathogenesis, Treatment, and Prevention in Vancouver, Canada. The World Health Organization is considering new recommendations based on the study. One would be to test infants born to women living with HIV at birth, and then again 4 to 6 weeks later. Supporters say this would reduce a woman's anxiety about her baby's health. Another recommendation would be to teach the women how to care for and feed the infant early on. The report also calls for women living with HIV to be provided with information about testing options, to give them time to make an informed choice about when to test. The ICW says the choice must be respected and the human rights of the mother protected. UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, says about 900 children are newly infected with HIV every day, nearly all of them in sub-Saharan Africa. It says 57% of pregnant women living with HIV received antiretrovirals to prevent the virus from being transmitted to their babies. But UNICEF also says only 35% of infants born to HIV-positive mothers in low- and middle-income countries were tested for the virus within the first 2 months of life. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Africa has made impressive economic strides in the last 20 years. High rates of growth followed years of tough austerity measures by the International Monetary Fund and international campaign to provide debt relief. Now, some fear African debt is growing again with potentially negative consequences. Andrew Hanauer is campaign's director of the Jubilee USA Network. It's an alliance of U.S. organizations and faith-based groups that works to protect the world's poorest and most vulnerable. Reporter William Eagle asked Hanauer what's behind Africa's rising debt.
Debt relief has been extremely effective and successful in Africa. I think you've seen over the last 15 years, the debt relief measures that have been implemented in Africa have increased school enrollment, reduced child mortality rates, that's according to a World Bank study, increased social spending on all of the sort of important things that governments need to invest in, health, education, infrastructure. So I think debt relief has been very effective. I think in some cases, probably more of it was needed. But in the longer term, debt relief is a fix for immediate concerns. It frees up resources. It gives countries the space and the room to spend money and grow their economy. But in the long term, we need to address structural causes. So reckless lending and borrowing policies. We need to address corporate tax avoidance, which is draining lots of money from these countries. We need to address corruption. There's been a recent study showing that sub-Saharan Africa is losing $50 billion a year to so-called illicit financial flows, which are a combination of corruption and crime and tax evasion. So if you have all this money coming out, it's not surprising that a lot of these countries are going to end up back in debt. And, of course, the last factor, I think, is the financial crisis in 2008, which was really hard on a lot of countries, but really hard on the poorest countries.
The new debt, is it public loans or private loans?
I think it's a combination. A number of these African countries have actually started to float bonds, which is a new thing, for them. And so you are seeing some private debt accumulate. I think it's concerning in part because we have also seen predatory financial behavior against these countries in the past, and I think, with the recent case between Argentina and predatory hedge funds, you may now have a court precedent that could allow those types of funds to target African countries and try to seize assets if they go into a situation where they need to default or restructure their debts. So the private debt is somewhat worrisome in the sense that it's much more free-flowing and less under control, but there is a combination of types.
Is it likely that African debt would once again attract the intervention of the World Bank and the IMF as it did 20 and 30 years ago in a situation similar to what Greece is going through today? And perhaps even with the same ideas on the part of the IMF for a solution, this sort of no debt relief but imposed austerity. Is that a concern for you?
Well, the concern, I think, for me is that the debt relief measures that we've won over the last 15 years have been so transformative and were so large in scope that it's possible that there would be some reluctance to do the same thing again, even if it was really what was needed. And so you see in Greece with the IMF, they did not provide debt relief under the last agreement a few years ago, and then later said that was a mistake, and now they're saying that, for better or for worse, debt relief is necessary for Greece at this stage if they're going to emerge and grow their economy. I think that's a good sign in the sense that, there's no reason that logic and that precedent would not apply to any country that's in that type of situation, whether it's in Africa or Europe or anywhere else.
What are some of the solutions that Jubilee is considering or proposing to support some form of debt relief or to ensure that Africa's debt doesn't get out of hand?
Sure. So, I think our solutions and what we would say, especially to that first point, responsible lending and borrowing is absolutely critical. That's where everything else has to come from. So, we've worked through United Nations bodies to advance principles of responsible lending and borrowing that the United States could adopt and has adopted voluntarily. That the World Bank and International Monetary Fund can adopt to make sure that when we're loaning money to countries, basic protections are in place. The same sorts of things that banks here in the United States have so that they're not loaning money recklessly or maliciously to individuals. And so that's the first piece. I think the second piece is we need an international bankruptcy system. And you saw just this week Pope Francis calling for that exact reform. And I think that's a system that would make sure that if a country gets to the point where they're, going to default or unable to pay their loans, there's a system in place that's fair, it's transparent, and that makes sure that the country's citizens are taken care of and that all the creditors are treated equally and fairly. And I think we also, as I mentioned, I think you can't address debt if you don't address the tax and transparency issues. You cannot be surprised that countries are falling back into debt when they're losing billions of dollars to corporate tax avoidance and to illicit financial flows. So those are the things that need to be addressed.
That was Andrew Hanauer of the Jubilee USA Network. He spoke to reporter William Eagle. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The East African nation of Burundi holds a controversial national election tomorrow after weeks of deadly violence. Special court in Senegal began a long-awaited trial today against former Chadian ruler Hissène Habré on charges of crimes against humanity. And U.S. President Barack Obama is hosting Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari for a meeting today at the White House. Coming up, music from Guinea, and in our feature segment, why full face veils, commonly called burqa and hijab by Muslim women, has been banned in all Cameroon's border areas. I'm Yehizu Heeb, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA Sports, with Sunny is next. Time now for this Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehias.
I understand you're teeing off with golf.
Yehias, final round action is taking place at the 144th British Open Golf Tournament in St. Andrews, Scotland. Joining us now with an update is VOA's Jonah Haskell. Hi, Jonah.
Hey, Sunny. And yes, despite the best efforts of the weather, the final round of the British Open is being played Monday. And after a wild weekend of stops and starts and restarts and restops, we may have a winner before the day is out. While the driving rain and gale force winds were the stories of Saturday and Sunday, Monday's excitement is provided by a very close race at the top of the leaderboard. Mark Leishman is currently the man to beat at 16 under, but as many as 15 other players are well within striking distance. One of those players is world number two Jordan Spieth. The young Texan, who won the Masters and the U.S. Open earlier this year, started the day one shot off the lead, but double bogeyed the eighth hole to drop back in the pack. Of course, this was before Spieth came storming back into contention with two consecutive birdies on 9 and 10. He now sits at 14 under. South African Louis Oosthuizen started the day tied for the lead and has stayed near the top of the leaderboard at 14 under as well. Oosthuizen won this tournament on this course in 2010, so count on him to be in the thick of it to the very end. Irish amateur Paul Dunne, who qualified for the Open by winning a play-in tournament, also started the day tied for the lead and has a chance to become the first amateur to win the Open since Bobby Jones did it 85 years ago in 1930. What a story that would be, although because he is an amateur, Dunne would not be eligible to collect the $1.8 million prize. Talk about missing out on a payday. Most players are still on the course at St. Andrews, but barring a tie, we should have a 2015 British Open champion by Tuesday morning. And now, moving south of the channel from the inclement weather of Scotland to sunny France, the Tour de France continued Monday with stage 16. Beginning the stage in the small town of Bourg-de-Péage, 82 miles south of Lyon, riders headed southeast towards the Italian border in the town of Gap. En route, they encountered the foothills of the Alps for the first time this year, having to climb two peaks, including the Col de Mans, which rose to 1,268 meters above sea level. Monday's winner was Spaniard Ruben Plaza Molina of Italian team Lampre Merida, who completed the 201-kilometer stage in 2 hours and 30 minutes. Coming in seventh was Daniel Tekle Heimanot of South African team MTN Kubeka. Tekle Heimanot, who is an Eritrean by birth, was the polka dot jersey holder earlier in the race before losing it during the Pyrenees stages. He will be looking to regain control of the climbers' competition as the race enters its final stages, which will take place amongst the lofty peaks of the French Alps. Chris Froome of the United Kingdom is still the race leader, with a 3-minute and 10-second lead over second place Nairo Quintana Rojas of Colombia. 2014 Tour winner Vincenzo Nibali of Kazakhstan is in 8th place, trailing Froome by about 7 minutes, while 2010 Tour de France champion Alberto Contador is also in contention, sitting 4 minutes behind Froome in 5th. On Tuesday, riders will set off from Digne-les-Bains and head straight into the tall mountains of the French-Italian border. The final stage will take place on July 26th in Paris. I'm VOA's Jonah Haskell. Back to you, Sonny.
Thanks, Jonah. In African football news, former Zimbabwe star Peter Ndlovu will be inducted into his country's Sports Hall of Fame. Reporter Michael Cariati tells us more from the capital, Harare.
Ndlovu is to be honored for his outstanding contributions as Warriors captain and for raising the Zimbabwe flag high while turning out for various clubs in England. He is the only Zimbabwean captain to take the Warriors to two Africa Cup of Nations finals in 2004 and 2006, and also became the first Zimbabwe black footballer in 1992 to play in the English Premiership. Sports and Recreation Commission Director of Business Daniel Kwengwa confirmed that they've come up with the list of the 10 inductees who are being presented to potential sponsors for the event.
We have discovered that our marketing strategy was wrong. We now need to market the Hall of Fame ceremony with the inductees, so that people would like now to be associated with inductees rather than asking for sponsorship without the inductees.
Lovu is to be honored alongside golfer Nick Price, the late rugby star Richard Simba, tennis aces Byron and Wayne Black, as well as former national team batsman Andy Flower. Kuenga said they've set their Hall of Fame plan in a way that the inductions would be held way before the annual National Sports Awards, with their target being September. The SRC Supremo said they are hoping for the first time since the Hall of Fame was introduced in 2005 to dish out some financial rewards to the inductees.
If we can give them something about $5,000 per inductee, yes, but some of them, for lack of a better word, they could be millionaires by now, which means 5,000 does not mean anything.
Although swimmer Kirsty Coventry automatically qualifies for that recognition, SRC spokesperson Tiruashe Nweyembwa said this honor is bestowed only on those who have since quit various sporting disciplines. The Zimbabwe Sports Hall of Fame is situated at the National Gallery, and a number of former stars, including footballer George Shire, athlete Atro Mandaza, boxer Langton Schoolboy Tinago, and the Golden Hockey Girls of 1980 were the first inductees. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Cariati.
Joining us now with more football news is our Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot on the spot at Ayemi.
Good evening, Africa. Sunday Olise has begun his reign as head coach of Nigeria's national team, the Super Eagles. Olise was signed on by the Nigeria Football Federation at his ceremony in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. This is coming 13 years after he captained the Super Eagles at the Africa Cup of Nations in Mali. He replaces Stephen Keshi, another former Eagles captain who was sacked by the Nigeria Football Federation 2 weeks ago. Speaking after his formal presentation, Olise said he will give his best to the job.
First of all, I'm not coming as a messiah. I'm not coming as a man who knows it all. I'm not coming as someone who can singularly, alone, just turn Nigeria into Germany. But I'm coming as a man who has come to serve his country and ready to give 150%.
Olise's immediate challenge is to qualify Nigeria for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations tournament, which will be hosted by Gabon. Nigeria, a three-time Nations Cup champion, kicked off its 2017 qualifying campaign with a 2-0 victory over visiting Chad last month in the northern city of Kaduna. Talking about Olise, I spoke with sports analyst Tony Nezianya, who has been keenly following the process that led to Olise's appointment as Nigeria's head coach.
It was something that is long overdue, that we needed to have somebody, and somebody who understands the system. He's played at the highest level, He possesses a FIFA license. So I think that that position has predisposed him, you know, to the kind of coaching that Nigeria desires at this moment.
That was sports analyst Tony Nezianya speaking on new Super Eagles head coach Sunday Olise. Let's now head to Gabon, where four-time World Player of the Year Lionel Messi laid the first stone of one of the venues to be used for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations tournament. The ceremony on Saturday was witnessed by Gabonese President Ali Bongo Ondimba. It was the Barcelona star's first trip to Gabon. The Gabonese president said Messi had promised him a few years ago during a meeting in Barcelona that he would visit him in Libreville, the Gabonese capital. The Port-Gentil stadium will have a capacity of 20,000. Port-Gentil is Gabon's second city and the country's oil capital. And from Brazil comes the report that soccer legend Pelé has successfully undergone a back surgery and is recovering well. The Albert Einstein Hospital in Sao Paulo did not say when the 74-year-old Pelé was expected to be discharged, but some reports said he would leave the hospital this week. This is the third time Pelé has been hospitalized since November. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks, Segun. In more African football news, Nigeria, Algeria, Mali, Egypt, and Morocco all posted victories over the weekend in qualifying matches for the African Under-23 Championship. Our VOA football fans will remember this tournament doubles as a qualifying tournament for next year's Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The scores: Nigeria defeated Congo Brazzaville 2-1. Algeria beat Sierra Leone 2-0. Mali edged Gabon 1-0. Egypt trounced Uganda 4-0. And Morocco topped Tunisia 1-0. There were two draws over the weekend. Ivory Coast and Zambia played a scoreless draw. And Zimbabwe and South Africa battled to a one-all draw. In Port Harcourt, Nigeria moved closer to an Olympic berth with that 2-1 victory over Congo Brazzaville. It was sweet revenge for the Nigerian boys, whose senior side lost 3-2 to Claude Lawa's Congo last year in a 2015 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying match. The hero on Sunday for the dream team of Nigeria was Junior Ajayi. He had both goals for the Nigerian team. Just after halftime, about 35,000 fans attended the match in Port Harcourt. Elsewhere, Egypt overwhelmed Uganda 4-0. Mahmoud Abdelmonaim bagged a brace for the Egyptian boys. So Egypt and Nigeria, two of the big winners over the weekend in Olympic football qualifying matches. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny, and thank you, Jonah. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sun has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, why full-scale veils, commonly called burqa or hijab, by Muslim women have been banned in all of Cameroon's border areas with Chad and Nigeria. And next, 16 young Zimbabwean entrepreneurs selected to participate in a summit on global entrepreneurship to be hosted by President Barack Obama in Kenya. But first, some music. Here is Sion of Camara of Guinea with Umu.
Thank you.
Guinness Ayun Kamara with Umu. The wearing of full face veils, commonly called burqa or hijab by Muslim women, has been banned in all of Cameroon's border areas with Chad and Nigeria. It's a region where suspected suicide bombers of the Boko Haram terrorist group have been operating. The decision was taken after women disguised as Muslims attacked Cameroon in a twin suicide bombing this week. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from Yaoundé.
Midiyawa Bakari, governor of far northern Cameroon, says the decision to impose the bans was taken as part of measures to stop suicide bombers after the country reported its first ever suicide bomb attack in the town of Fotokol on the border with Nigeria's Borno State, the former stronghold of the terrorist group Boko Haram. He said the two suicide bombers, whose heads were cut off by the bombs they wore, were women wearing face veils.
Most of the suicide bombers, if not all, which are well reported, were disguised in veil, popular called burqa. And so, we are today more than ever before calling on the population of this region to be on the alert and report to the authority that to be any suspicious activity or person. It is not only about the veil or burqa, but all about any activities and thing which is likely to jeopardize our peace and security. This means that all citizens should participate in protecting this beautiful nation from enemies like Boko Haram militants.
About 20% of Cameroon's 22 million people are Muslims. 40% are Christians, and the rest hold various traditional beliefs. Sunnis make up 75% of the Muslims, and Shiites, who insist on wearing the veil, constitute about 25%. Mairama Abubakar was traveling from far north Cameroon, where the ban is effect, to the capital Yaoundé, with the burqa covering all of her face. She told VOA she was respecting a religious obligation.
En Islam, il est obligatoire pour toute femme de porter le voile parce que.
She says Islam makes it an obligation for each woman to wear a burqa because it is decreed by God through His Prophet Muhammad to preserve a woman's dignity. She adds it is also very important because it preserves the woman and adds value to the Muslim culture. Abubakar says wearing the veil is not negotiable, even if arrested.
Non, j'ai pas peur si on m'arrête, parce que ça fait partie d'une obligation pour moi de rabattre le voile sur moi.
She says she is not afraid. It is unlawful in Islam to arrest someone just because she wore a veil, which is an obligation from God. It is not permitted, she says. Muhammad Sani from the Central Mosque in Marwa, far northern Cameroon, says barely a day after the ban was announced, there were crackdowns on Muslims when it has not been established the suicide bombers were Muslims.
C'est pas seulement les musulmans qui portent ces voiles, puisque c'est un aspect particulier pour les musulmans.
He says not only Muslims wear such veils, and many people have been hiding behind it and behind Islam to commit atrocities. So he thinks that the government should tackle the issues instead of persecuting Muslims. He says non-Muslims can wear and are wearing burqas. Ntuda Ebode, a geopolitical scientist, says Cameroon was late in banning the burqa.
Lorsque le Tchad décide d'interdire, le Cameroun est dans la même coalition que le Tchad.
He says Cameroon should have banned the burqa when Tchad announced it had banned it, because the two countries are in the same coalition fighting against Boko Haram. Last month, Chad also banned full-face veils after suicide bombers used them and attacked the country. The ban on veils and gatherings in large numbers by Muslims has scared many of them and kept many of them carrying out works of charity. Moki, Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
16 young Zimbabwean entrepreneurs have been selected to participate in a summit on global entrepreneurship to be hosted by President Barack Obama in Kenya. One of those invited to the event is Zimbabwean entrepreneur Tuwanda Chikosi, who tells a reporter, Marvelous Malanga Nihiwi, some may fail to attend the summit due to lack of money.
Zimbabwean entrepreneurs that are going to the Global Entrepreneurship Summit in Kenya is actually 19. The arrangements that we have in place, together with a colleague of mine from Hypercube Hub called Costa Nyanzero, we made an initiative on behalf of the 19 participants and went to have a meeting with the Kenyan Airways people to try and find a way that ensures that each and every one of our 19 participants that have been invited will get an opportunity to be there. So the Kenyan Airways has been very helpful to us. They have spoken to a travel agency with the arrangement they have to allow us to go to Kenya by just paying a difference of about $324 for the flight, and the rest of the money that we were given support by the U.S. Embassy in Harare, which is $500 per person, would be paid directly to them to offset the total cost of the flight, which is $824. After having been given again a discount of 10% per individual by the Kenyan Airways. So this is exactly where we stand as of today.
And what does it mean for you personally as a young entrepreneur being given this opportunity to go and represent your country, Zimbabwe, at this global summit in Kenya?
Just like everybody else who has represented his country, there's an element and a feeling of being immensely proud to be one of the young people to be chosen to represent the country. Personally, I think it is an opportunity to learn. Zimbabwe is so far away from the action in terms of entrepreneurial startups and the support ecosystems that are being given in East Africa as well as in West Africa. So we feel like we are a bit behind in terms of mechanisms, support systems, as well as systems operationally. So getting there is a moment where you get to mix and mingle with the best talent that has been selected from an entrepreneurial field to attend.
That's Tuwanda Chikosi, a young Zimbabwean entrepreneur, speaking to reporter Marvelous Malanga Nihai from Harare. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Cornelius Tiener, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago this month, South Sudan celebrated its independence with much jubilation and great hope that a split from the North would finally put an end to decades of civil war. That, unfortunately, was not to be. The relative peace that followed lasted all of 18 months. In December 2013, a political schism evolved into widespread conflict that, in part, devolved along ethnic lines. The conflict is remarkable in its brutality against civilians. This has been stated in a number of reports from NGOs and the United Nations that take note of human rights violations and abuses committed by both sides. They range from ethnically motivated murders to gang rapes and the mass destruction and looting of civilian property. Thousands have been killed, 2.4 million have been displaced, and almost 4.6 million are in need of humanitarian aid. On June 27th, the United States urged the United Nations Security Council to blacklist six rival commanders from South Sudan for threatening that country's peace and stability. On the government side, they are Major General Mario Changwang Yao Mangwak, Lieutenant General Gabriel Jokriak, and Major General Santino Dengwal. Rebel leaders to be sanctioned are Major Generals Simon Gatwich Dual, James Koang Chual, and Peter Gadet. In a July 1st vote, the Security Council agreed. All six had previously been sanctioned by our Treasury Department regarding their financial transactions. South Sudan's political leadership has squandered the international goodwill that accompanied its independence and pursued political and economic self-interest that has produced only violence, displacement, and suffering for the South Sudanese people, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Samantha Power. Political and military leaders on all sides of this conflict must put aside their self-serving ambitions, end the fighting, and engage in negotiations to establish a transitional government.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.